I'm Michael Brennis, and this is the Showbiz Roundup. Cisco Bradley is a noted historian and professor whose new book documents the experimental avant-garde music scene on the Brooklyn waterfront between 1988 and 2014. The scene sprouted in the harsh post-industrial landscape of Williamsburg and grew until it was pushed out by gentrification. Cisco's document preserves an art form so ephemeral that in many cases it might otherwise have been lost to history. Today's show is a bit of a departure from our normal routine here at the Showbiz Roundup. Normally we talk to musicians and sometimes dancers and other performers. But today my guest is an associate professor of history at the Pratt Institute in New York and has had a long-standing interest in and involvement with the creative experimental music scene in Brooklyn. His new book is The Williamsburg Avant-Garde, Experimental Music and Sound on the Brooklyn Waterfront. Cisco Bradley, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
You are a professor of history at the Pratt Institute, but it turns out you're also one of our own. You have 3 degrees from the University of Wisconsin-Madison, including a PhD in history from 2010, but you're originally from Montana. How did you find your way to Wisconsin?
So, I mean, I should say, I was born in Montana, but my family moved to Wisconsin when I was about 2 years old. So I grew up in Portage. Just north of Madison, where I went to high school. And then I did, as you were saying, undergrad and then graduate school at the University of Wisconsin.
How would you describe the particular historical niche that you're working in now? And how did you get interested in this area?
Yeah, I began to be interested in jazz as early as junior high. Growing up, I played violin, piano, and trombone. And trombone is where I really kind of connected with jazz. So, at an early age, I loved the music. Never would have foreseen that I'd be, writing about it later on in life. But it was really during graduate school, around maybe 2003 or four, when I was doing a lot of intense studying, and I wanted to find music that didn't have words, and that I could sort of listen to while I was studying. And so I just kind of got back into jazz around that time. And I quickly became more and more attracted to the more experimental stuff, which I thought, was really kind of an exploration of new sound and ways of pushing the boundaries of the music and pushing the boundaries of instruments and coming up with, interesting ensembles, sort of unusual ideas, that people would be kind of bringing to the music. So from that point on, I just kind of fell in love with a lot of this. And, at that time, at least my impression was at that time that there wasn't as much happening in Madison around this music then than I think there is now. There's some great organizations that have emerged. And it could also be that I was missing some of the stuff that was happening at the time, but I started to connect with the music scene in Chicago. I've always been a big fan of the Chicago music and the aesthetic of the music there. I feel like it's uncompromising and there's something about, that city that I think has produced a lot, generation after generation of incredible musicians. So I started going to concerts in Chicago and, also started to listen to a lot of musicians via records, that were active elsewhere. So I started to connect with the New York scene around 2004 or five, listening to figures like William Park, who I later wrote a biography of, and many other musicians operating in New York, and also connecting with the young, sort of the next generation, younger generation of musicians that are kind of pushing the music forward. So for a long time, I would say I listened primarily to the music on record. I could only get down to Chicago every so often. So through the 2000s, up until I graduated in 2010, to me, you know, much of the music was through records. And so I lucked, you know, in many ways, I felt like very fortunate to have landed a job in New York. And then I started to go to the music. And once I got to New York, I just started going to maybe 3 or 4 concerts a week for the first couple of years I was here. And I was just seeing as much as I possibly could. And that just kind of cemented, my interests in the music. And then I started to, really think about writing about it.
Early in the last century, Williamsburg was considered the most densely populated area of New York City. And then in the early 60s, it was a manufacturing center with roughly 100,000 jobs or so, manufacturing jobs. And then in 1990, that number was down by about 90%. In your book, gentrification and displacement are big themes, but it seems like disinvestment is also essential to this cycle. Williamsburg deindustrialized, the city carved it up with massive urban freeways, destroying homes. Can you talk about why the city more or less abandoned the generations of people who lived in Williamsburg and what created this environment of vacant industrial spaces and low rents that attracted a wave of experimental musicians?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think a lot of the economics that had a devastating effect on Williamsburg were felt elsewhere. You know, you think of the deindustrialization, that the U.S. has faced more broadly. I mean, think of, cities like Detroit and Cleveland and Buffalo and Baltimore, and we can make a very long list. A lot of cities, that relied on manufacturing as the core of their kind of employment, job base. Williamsburg certainly felt that. And I think a lot of Williamsburg had a big surge, I think, even during World War II, where there were a lot of manufacturing happening there that was connected to the military in certain ways. And then a lot of sort of industrial, chemical companies and a mustard factory and, sugar factory, a range of things. And most of those just, because of this sort of broader economic trend, by the 70s began, really kind of closing down. There were big stretches of post-industrial landscape right along the water, which from today's perspective, people think, oh, that's prime real estate. It's right on the water, and have a hard time imagining it not being inhabited, and now it's been converted over to residential mostly. So, but I mean, in that time, one of the things that kind of filled the gap, I think, there, or what the land began to be used for, is a lot of waste processing facilities. A lot of, people say the garbage of New York City was being sent to Williamsburg to be processed, that sort of thing. So that the neighborhood itself became, I think, very, unpleasant in some ways. I mean, in recent times, there are a few processing areas that are a little further inland. And if you get anywhere near them, you can smell them. So, it's not a pleasant situation. So there's, stuff like that. So that's part of it. And one of the other things, those empty warehouses, they weren't completely unused. There was certainly a sort of a shadow economy of narcotics being run through there, especially in the 1980s. Mm. I mean, you have open warehouses that weren't being used. So, if you read about New York's crack epidemic in that time, one of the epicenters for that was Williamsburg. That started to get pushed out by maybe around 1990 and on. So there's things like that that made the neighborhood, I think, difficult for people. But we should remember, there are the industrial sections right along the water, and they're residential not too far away. And the residential areas, of course, were inhabited by communities, some of which had been there for generations. So when you have the Puerto Rican community in South Williamsburg, you have the Polish American community in North Williamsburg, and certainly there are Jewish communities in South Williamsburg as well. So, and of course many other people. Those were cohesive communities, that were really kind of adjacent to a lot of these areas. So then I think, even as early as the 70s, artists began to discover it. But I think it was a slow process. And it was mostly painters, who were connected in some way to the art scene in Manhattan. Not much was really happening in Williamsburg itself in terms of galleries or music venues until the mid to late 80s. And around 87, a lot of people say around 1987 is when the community began to gain a kind of critical mass. My book looks at the period 1988 to 2014. Mm-hmm. So, I'm specifically looking at experimental music, a lot of music that wasn't necessarily commercial. I mean, some people found a way to make it commercial, but a lot of it wasn't commercial. So it could rent maybe 5,000 square feet of space for, $500 or something, and those prices today just seem impossible.
Yeah.
You get a studio apartment for probably 5,000 or something in Williamsburg today. So, the prices have just gone through the roof. So artists began moving there because it was possible to live there cheaply. There's even cases where some artists just squatted buildings. They would move in and maybe take over an old factory or warehouse or something and just live there because the landlords had moved away and given up on the property. And so that kind of sort of informal arrangements, those were also possible. And then, late 80s into the 90s, a real local scene began to take off. It's connected on the subway to the east, the Lower East Side, the East Village, which is, of course, where it was sort of the heart of the Manhattan arts community in a lot of ways. And so it's just one subway stop over, and it happens to be on the other side of the river, but it made it pretty convenient, and artists could continue to be connected to kind of the action that was happening in Manhattan. But as it gained critical mass, it meant suddenly people were thinking, well, we don't have to only show our work at galleries in Manhattan. We could be doing it right here. And same thing with music. So music venues began to take off. And I think the exciting thing about a space like that, like the spaces that existed in Williamsburg, was really that artists can often control the spaces. It's a loft setting where artists were moving into warehouses or factories, putting up walls, maybe creating stages, really in control of the space. And then they were presenting work often in their own living spaces in a way, because there was a lot of space, it was possible for an artist to say, like, okay, they might have had their bedroom in one part and a kitchen, but then they might have, create a whole large room that could fit 100 people or even more in some cases, maybe a couple hundred people. And often working in tandem with other artists, and in a collective type of way, they were able to put on shows. And so, I think that really kind of sparked it, and people were excited to be there because there was space. And then there was, of course, a growing community by the 90s.
I suppose we can agree that the populations of people who built these communities over generations, maybe they constitute the first wave of the displaced.
Yeah.
And I wonder if you would agree that artists who inhabited these post-industrial spaces, investing their energy, time, talents in kind of a cultural transformation, would you consider them to be sort of the second wave of casualties when the gentrifiers arrived in earnest? And, neither group sort of reaps any of the rewards of having built these sort of attractive, culturally rich communities.
Yeah, I think that's fairly accurate. I think displacement, of course, was varied. Some communities were hit more than others. And it's a complex process because I think in the 80s into the 90s, I think there was a gradual increase in rent generally in Williamsburg. But it really kind of, there were a couple of things that happened later that made it, that suddenly led to a much greater surge. So, there was a gradual increase in rent in the 90s. But there are really two events that really fully transformed the neighborhood really dramatically. And the first was 9/11, because for the first time, there were a lot of Manhattanites that were displaced by 9/11. because living in lower Manhattan became really difficult and unhealthy, and undesirable in a lot of ways for a while. So there were people who had probably never considered moving across the river. You know, there's always this sort of Manhattan centrism sometimes, and I think in the mentality. Suddenly there, you know, you had not just artists moving there, but you know, by 2002, 2001, 2002, 2003, suddenly there were people working in finance, people working in, you know, other sort of, occupations that were looking for, housing in Brooklyn. And so that was a big pressure. So I think that's a big step. And then the other one, and that kind of led up to 2005, where Mayor Michael Bloomberg oversaw rezoning of the neighborhood, where most of it had been zoned industrial. So that meant developers couldn't erect buildings for residential use. Even though, of course, a lot of these post-industrial spaces were being used for residential by artists and stuff. But after 2005, it was a sort of dramatic shift, because when that was rezoned, I think it was 186 blocks of Williamsburg were changed. And that meant within a year or two, most of those blocks were being seen by developers as sort of prime real estate. So some of the venues that I talk about, especially the early ones, the warehouse venues that were operating in the early 90s, and some of the outdoor concerts that were happening along the waterfront, all that is gone, physically gone, and has been replaced by, say, luxury condo towers, like the ones that are right there, I think, at North 7th Street on Kent Avenue, which is right on the water. And now it went from being, post-industrial, maybe hip artist neighborhood very rapidly to being a neighborhood that only the wealthy can really afford to live in. So, the transformation was fairly quick and very dramatic.
Do you feel that the music of the Williamsburg waterfront, especially that developed between 1988 and 2014, the period covered in your book, do you think that would exist had conditions not been ripe to cultivate it? If not for Williamsburg, would avant-garde experimental creative music be different today?
100%. I think I think the most important thing for any kind of thriving art scene or music scene is art space. So, if that space hadn't been available, most of this, I'd say, wouldn't have happened. And, not only were people playing there and creating the scene and impacting the rest of New York, but this, it had a national and even an international impact. So there's a lot of, really important artists that emerged out of the scene, have had a big mark kind of on experimental music over the past, 30, 35 years. So, I think the short answer is, without that community forming, without those spaces being available, I think largely most of that wouldn't have happened, or those artists might have done something else. But I think, there is something about meeting, having a neighborhood where so many people were living near each other. They're inspiring each other. They're seeing each other. They're collaborating with each other. And so that's really key.
Do you think the Williamsburg scene is a descendant in some way from, like, the downtown scene, where younger musicians seeking out sort of that legacy of the loft scene or the downtown scene, but got priced out of Manhattan?
Yeah. And really, I talk about this briefly in the early parts of the book, but the Lower East Side, which had been kind of the heart of, Lower East Side in the East Village, those were the heart, kind of the heart and soul of the arts community in New York, and had been for a number of, several decades. That had begun gentrifying. So musicians who were arriving, in New York by the early 90s were beginning to not be able to afford Manhattan. So, going across the river and finding a place there was, I think, fairly natural. So, and I think in many ways it's a descendant of some of those scenes. But I think, there are a lot of roots that went into the Williamsburg tree, if I can use that metaphor. certainly there was free jazz, you know, the whole downtown scene that was, you know, really instrumental in informing Williamsburg. There certainly were roots that went into earlier scenes in New York around punk, post-punk scene, like going all the way back to CBGB's on the Bowery and some of the other communities that had formed. So I think, you know, like that's sort of a route into it. Some of the experimental stuff that was happening in the downtown scene, figures like John Zorn, you know, Zena Parkins, many other people who kind of came out of that scene, and too many to list really, who, you know, were maybe impacted by jazz, but they were taking a lot of stuff from, I mean, a huge range of influences that were beyond that aesthetic as well. I mean, you have people drawing from rock music, from punk, from no wave, from electronics, people impacted by DJs. And I think in Williamsburg, really an increasing kind of influence from noise, especially Japanese noise bands, but kind of other sorts of noise experiments that have been happening in the, you know, throughout this period. So, you know, I think that's another big route. Yeah. So I think Williamsburg had a lot, you know, it was a lot of drawing from a lot of places. And then you also have creative composition happening in the academies. So music schools, New England Conservatory, Wesleyan University, you know, Berklee College of Music in Boston, Oberlin College, you know, Oberlin being another place, a lot of different places where people where this new generation was kind of training. Yeah. And I think what people get there is they may have studied jazz, but they probably also studied classical music. So you start getting, I think, you know, maybe a greater focus on composition a little bit through that. So yeah, I mean, it's a wide range of influences, but they're all kind of feeding into the Williamsburg scene. You'll see the bands that came out of this scene, I think we're all kind of drawing from these different elements in you know, greater or lesser degrees.
Yeah, we just had Chris Speed on the show not too long ago. He was part of that wave.
Oh, cool. Yeah, I love his work.
Living in Windsor Terrace and very much a part of that wave of folks from academia or however you want to put it. Do you feel like music is even tied to geography now? Has the internet done away with musicians gathering in communities to collectively challenge and support each other? Has the nature of music changed such that the paths that younger musicians take now may not even be recognizable to those of us who had to be in the same room with other people in order to develop as musicians?
Yeah, yes and no. I think geography is maybe a little less important than it used to be. I don't think people, you know, I think there used to be this sense for musicians, and I've interviewed musicians from all over the country, and people feel like, you know, they had to go to, you know, Chicago, Los Angeles, or New York, or whatever, you know, like the, you know, kind of having that feeling, or Detroit, or places that really there was a recording industry. I think that's less, you know, and that's where the live scenes really thrive in those cities. Yeah, I think it's less true now, but I don't think it's completely unimportant, because, you know, music is a communal art form. So I think there is sometimes there is to a certain degree a need to at least be able to form community. And of course, some of that can happen online. So I think there are some things that can happen that way. And then, of course, there's something, you know, I think that it still is vital for people to meet and be able to play and rehearse and all of that. I think also the real question now is where to get an audience. Because I don't think, you know, I say this as an observer of the New York scene. New York has an amazing amount of stuff happening, but it's often not with huge audiences. Hmm. And I think that shocks people. I talk to my friends who are organizing concerts in Madison, and they regularly get way more people at a single concert there than I've ever seen happen really in New York, other than maybe a few festivals. I mean, I regularly go to concerts in New York where there might be 20 people, you know, 30 people seems like a decent crowd at a lot of, especially the underground stuff. So, you know, I think, you know, the city has changed. I think the tastes of the inhabitants have changed in New York. I mean, there's just different people living here now than there were 40 years ago. I think there's maybe less of an appetite for experimental music, but there still is this element. So, yeah, I don't think people have to go to New York to get an audience. So I think that's kind of an interesting thing. And yeah, I think there's a lot of, you know, people, you know, a lot of people talk about almost like, you know, post-apocalyptic sort of, you know, feelings of, about, you know, what's happening to the music scene in New York. And I think it will always persist and it will always keep going. We have, you know, amazing amount of stuff happening here. But I also think it's good. I actually think it's a good thing for everywhere else in the country to actually have artists that maybe don't feel like they have to go to New York. I mean, you know, you could pick an instrument. There's probably several hundred amazing, you know, saxophone players in the city of New York. You know, do we need all, you know, I mean, like, and you go to another city and there might only be five. Yeah. So, you know, I think there is room for a lot of artistic growth in other places. And I don't think that's a bad thing. As much as I love New York and I've lived here for a long time. So, yeah, I mean, I think it's complex. And I think artist communities can form and thrive elsewhere more as well, just because I think the internet allows people to try to get reviews, try to get all these things where it used to have to be a journalist had to come to your live show, you know, and see you play. I mean, now, you know, you can send somebody some digital files and maybe get a review. So I think it's opening up opportunities just as much as maybe it's closing them in certain places, opening them in others.
Mm-hmm. I certainly remember hearing back in the day from friends who lived in New York and played in New York about, you know, gigs paid $50 or something and the audience wasn't that great. But at the same time, I remember going to the Knitting Factory or Tonic or someplace like that and having a show just be wall to wall. So maybe that's kind of a thing of the past these days.
Well, you know, I don't want to say, you know, that never happens, but I think part of the issue really, and I think this began as the music scene moved from Manhattan to Brooklyn, it's moving out of the city center. That is just the fact. So if something was happening in central New York, you know, like right in the center of the city, somewhere in Manhattan, I think you would get bigger audiences because more people can get there. Mm-hmm. If something's happening in a basement in you know, Bushwick or you know, I mean, and I've gone to so many of those shows, and those are some of my favorite shows. But it's just, you know, you're not necessarily going to get, you know, hundreds and hundreds of people showing up for concerts if just getting there is difficult. Maybe the train lines don't work or the, you know, that don't connect. And much of Brooklyn, I mean, is, you know, a lot of artists have moved in. They live in different neighborhoods. North Brooklyn and South Brooklyn are really only connected on the subway through, you know, going into Manhattan, mm-hmm. You know, aside from one other train line. So, you know, it's not always convenient, you know, for people to kind of be able to connect. So I think there's some sort of, you know, I don't know, geographic and kind of logistical barriers sometimes. But, you know, stuff continues to happen and there's always something new happening. I should say every night there's probably six or eight concerts that I would like to go to. And so it's sort of a luxury to have so much happening.
We're beginning to see that happening again in Madison, you know, from a late pandemic perspective or something. Suddenly from having nothing, we get two or three things on the same night. Often there are weekend nights or something, but yeah. During the early part of the period you cover in this book, the internet was not what it is today. In doing research for this program, I've tried to find tour schedules or club calendars from this period and given up. I mean, of course, I'm not a trained historian, but how much of this book relies on your firsthand experience being in Brooklyn and going to shows? How much of it relies on the memories of musicians and club owners? And what other sources did you find to fill in the details that you write about in this book?
Yeah, so I mean, I had to do a lot of different kinds of research. I mean, I should say, I lived in New York in 2000 for most of that year. I left, and I should say, when I lived here in 2000, I lived in Manhattan. I never once went to Brooklyn. So if I had known what was going on the other side of the river, I would have been over there all the time. So, you know, I was ignorant of what was going on at that time. When I moved back in 2011, so in a lot of ways, I saw just kind of the the very last years of Williamsburg kind of being the center, and then the music scene has moved elsewhere in other parts of Brooklyn. So, I mean, I did get to have some firsthand knowledge, but it's definitely not the, definitely wasn't the primary source for my writing. The biggest part of it was interviewing musicians. So I did I created a really massive oral history database. I interviewed about 250 people. I ended up using 182 of those interviews for this book, just because those are the interviews that tied in with the Williamsburg part of things. I definitely have plans to maybe use some of the other, to write about other aspects of the music scene, during those same years. But primarily I was, talking to musicians and getting their perspectives, talking to them about their work, sometimes talking to them about economics, if people wanted to share, kind of talking through all these different issues and trying to get a sense of the history of all these different bands. I mean, I cover so many different bands in the book. And then there was a bit of archival work. So I spent 2 years in the early phases of the research just reconstructing what happened. So I made a long Word document with, and organized it by venue and then by date within each venue, and just a list of every show that ever happened. So I'd have a sense of like, oh, okay, this venue was really active during these years and then it closed down, or, could try to get that kind of sense. So I think that Word document, it's 857 pages or something. It's one of these things. I started out thinking, oh, I'll just put all this in. It'll be like, 50 pages or something, and not really thinking about the how big that was going to be. So, I mean, that took a while, and it was probably overkill in some ways. So I definitely got data on places that weren't necessarily in Williamsburg or whatever, but I wanted to have a big picture sense of what had happened. So I did that. And then I would say the other source really is privately maintained archives that were, that musicians had. And that's all informal. I would interview somebody and they would say, oh, I did keep some of my flyers from back in those days. So, I have these old posters or whatever. Some people keep might have photocopied reviews that they got out of a newspaper or things like that. So I started to prowl through those. And a lot of people don't maintain those, but there were some people who did. And those were kind of invaluable, because I feel like it allowed me to go deeper into some of the work that way. And really it's about kind of taking all these sources and then bringing them together, in some way, and seeing how they connect with each other. I mean, really, I think I used that my concert database was sometimes often the guide for me. And then I would reach out to musicians like, oh, can you tell me, I see that your band was playing a lot of concerts, in 2004 and 2005 or something, just as an example, let's talk about that. How did that band come together? And that would kind of guide me as I was going through and doing the research.
And finally, do you feel like if you hadn't documented all of this, how much of it would have been at risk of being lost to history?
Well, music is a very ephemeral art form, and it sort of, a lot of the evidence of it disappears over time. Live music, there's no physical evidence of it once it's over. Unless someone has, bootlegged a recording or something. So, I think documenting is really important. I don't want to overstate my importance, but I think any kind of documentation like this is important. And I would say there are many other music scenes happening simultaneously, and some even in Williamsburg and some elsewhere in New York City, that I think also should be documented. And if it doesn't happen, and I think so much of it is embedded in the memories of the musicians themselves. If you don't interview people, if those aren't written down, eventually it fades. It does fade. Because, if people move away or pass away or whatever, the history of that, which I think is largely an oral phenomenon, is lost. So, yeah, I'm really proud of having worked on this particular scene. And tried to recover as much as I could. When I read back through the book, I often think, there's, in some ways, I mean, the book covers a lot, but in some ways it's still just scratching the surface because there was so much happening, you know, so much amazing music of that era that, you know, I was proud of what I got, but you know, there's a lot more work to be done too.
Well, Cisco Bradley, thank you so much for stopping by the show today. It's been great pleasure to talk to you. I was really looking forward to this conversation, and I hope people pick up the book. It's a very interesting read, hopefully even for folks who weren't around for part of that. And I hope people come out to your reading, which I think is on October 28th.
That's right.
At the North Street Cabaret.
Yeah, thank you. It's a real honor to be on your show and give a shout out to all of my Madison people. So really, thank you so much.
That's it for this edition of the Showbiz Roundup. Our theme music is a composition by me, performed by Outside the Sphere, an experimental duo consisting of Tony Barba and myself, with special guest Sebastian Brennis on trombone. If you'd like more info about this show, you can head over to bluestemjazz.org. Be sure to check out the venue's website at northstreetcabaret.com. And you can follow my doings or be in touch via rattletickbuzz.com. Catch you later.